It's an M1873 Colt single-action army revolver, Foster replied, lifting it from the equally authentic three-person's holster. The gun that won the West. Dmitri, I never go riding without a friend, he said with a self-satisfied smile. 45? The Russian asked. He'd seen them in movies, but never in real life. No, it's a 44-40, caliber 44 with 40 grains of black powder. Back 100 years ago, you used the same cartridge in your handgun and your rifle, cheaper that way, he explained. And the bullet'll kill just about anything you want. Maybe not a buffalo, he allowed, but damn sure a deer. Or a man? You bet. This is just about the deadliest cartridge ever made, Dmitri. Honeycutt replaced the revolver in the leather holster. Now, this holster isn't authentic, really. It's called a three-persons, named for Billy Three-Persons, I think. He was a U.S. Marshal back in the old days. He was a Native American, too, and quite a lawman, so the story goes. Anyway, he invented the holster late in the 19th century. Easier to quick draw out of this one, see? Foster demonstrated. It impressed Popoff to see it in real life after so many movies. The American hunter even wore a wide-brim Western hat. Popoff found himself liking the man despite his bombast. "Come on, Jeremiah," Honeycutt said, as the other two entered the corral, and with that he led them off. "Your horse?" Popoff asked. "Oh, yeah, bought him off a Nez Perce Indian pal. 8 years old, just about right for me." Foster smiled as they walked out the gate. A man fully in his element, Popoff thought. The rides had become somewhat repetitive. Even here there was only so much land to walk and examine. But the simple pleasure of it hadn't changed. The four men went north this morning, slowly through the prairie dog town, then close to the interstate highway with its heavy truck traffic. "Where is the nearest town?" Popoff asked. "That way," Kilgore pointed, "about 5 miles. Not much of a town." "Does it have an airport?" "Little one, for private planes only," the doctor replied. "You go east about 20 miles, there's another town with a regional airport for puddle jumpers. So you can get to Kansas City. From there you can fly anywhere." "But we'll be using our own runways for the G's, right?" "Yep," Kilgore confirmed. "The new ones can hop all the way to Johannesburg from right here." "No shit," Honeycutt asked. "You mean, like, we could go hunting in Africa if we want?" "Yeah, Foster, but packing back the elephant on a horse might be a little tough." The epidemiologist laughed. "Well, maybe just the ivory," the hunter replied, doing the same. "I was thinking lion and leopard, John." "Africans like to eat the lion's gonads. You see, the lion is the most virile of all the animals," Kilgore told them. "How's that?" "Once upon a time, a nature film crew watched 2 males servicing a female who was in season. They averaged once every 10 minutes for a day and a half between them. So the individual males were going 3 times an hour for 36 hours. Better than I ever did." There was another laugh that the men all shared. "Anyway, some African tribes still believe that when you eat a body part off something you killed, you inherit the attribute of that part. So they like to eat lion balls." "Does it work?" McLean asked. Kilgore liked that. "If it did, wouldn't be many male lions left in the world, Kirk." "You got that one right, John." And there was more general laughter that dawn. Popoff wasn't as amused by this discussion as his companions. He looked off at the highway and saw a Greyhound bus pass by at about 70 miles per hour. But then it slowed and stopped at an odd little square building. "What's that?" he asked. "Bus stop for the intercity buses," Mark Waterhouse replied. "They have them out here in the boonies. You sit there and wait. Then you wave for the bus to stop, like the old flag stops for trains."
"Ah."
Dmitri filed that one away as he turned his horse to the east. The hawk he saw, the one that lived around here, was up and flying again, looking down for one of those tubular rodents to eat for its own breakfast. He watched, but evidently the hawk didn't see one. They rode for another hour, then headed back. Popoff ended up next to Honeycutt. "You been riding how long?"
"Hardly more than a week," Dmitri Arkadyevich answered.
"You're doing okay for a tenderfoot," Foster told him in a friendly voice.
"I want to do it more so that I can ride better at a faster pace."
"Well, how about tonight, just for sundown, say?"
"Thank you, Foster. Yes, I would like that.
Just after dinner, shall we say?"
"Sure. Meet me around 6:30 at the corral."
"Thank you. I will do that," Popoff promised.
A night ride under the stars. Yes, that should be very pleasant.
"I got an idea," Chatham said when he got to work in the Javits building.
"What's that?"
"This Russian guy, Serov. We got a passport photo, right?"
"Yeah," Sullivan agreed.
"Let's try the flyers again. His bank, it's probably within walking distance of his apartment, right?"
"You'd think so, wouldn't you?"
"I like it," Special Agent Tom Sullivan said with some enthusiasm. "Let's see how fast we can get that done."
"Hey, Chuck," the voice said over the phone.
"Good morning.
Afternoon for you, I suppose, John."
"Yeah, just finished lunch," Clark said.
"Any luck with this Serov investigation?"
"Nothing yet," the assistant director for the criminal division answered. "These things don't happen overnight, but they do happen. I have the New York Field Division looking for this mutt."
"If he's in town, we'll find him," Baker promised.
"It might take a while, but we will."
"Sooner is better than later," Rainbow Six pointed out.
"I know. It always is, but stuff like this doesn't happen overnight."
Baker knew that he was being kicked in the ass, lest he allow this hunt to become a low-priority item. That would not happen. But this Clark guy was CIA, and he didn't know what it was like to be a cop.
"We'll find the guy for you, John.
If he's over here, that is.
You have the British cops looking, too?"
"Oh, yeah.
Thing is, we don't know how many identities he might have."
"In his place, how many would you have?"
3 or 4, probably. And they'd be similar, so they're easy for me to remember. This guy's a trained spook, so he probably has a number of legends that he can change into about as easy as he changes shirts."
"I know, John. I've worked foreign counterintelligence before. They are elusive game, but we know how to hunt 'em."
"Are you sweating any more stuff out of your terrorists?"
"They don't talk all that much," the voice replied. "The cops here can't interrogate very effectively."
"So are we supposed to roast them over a slow fire?" Baker didn't ask.
The FBI operated under the rules established by the U.S. Constitution. He figured that CIA most often did not, and, like most FBI types, he found that somewhat distasteful. He'd never met Clark and knew him only by reputation. Director Murray respected him but had his reservations. Clark had once tortured subjects, Murray had hinted once, and that, for the FBI, was beyond the pale, however effective it might be. The Constitution said no on that issue, and that was that, even for kidnappers, even though that was one class of criminal that deserved it in the eyes of every special agent of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. "Trust the Brit cops. They're damned good, John, and they have a lot of experience with IRA types. They know how to talk to them."
"You say so, Chuck," the voice responded somewhat dubiously.
"Okay, anything else we get comes right to your desk."
"Good. Talk to you later if we get anything here, John."
"Right, see ya."
Baker wondered if he should visit the bathroom to wash his hands after that conversation. He'd been briefed into Rainbow and its recent activities, and while he admired the military way of doing things, like many FBI agents, he'd been a Marine officer,
recruited right out of the Quantico Marine Base into the Bureau. It differed in several important areas from the Bureau's way of doing things, like not violating the law. This John Clark was a hard-case son of a bitch, a former agency guy who'd done some spooky things, Dan Murray had told him, with a mixture of admiration and disapproval. But what the hell? They were on the same side, sort of, and this Russian subject had probably initiated an operation that had gone after Clark's own family. That added a personal element to the case, and Baker had to respect that. Chavez turned in after another long day of watching athletes run and sweat. It had been an interesting couple of weeks, and though he sorely missed Patsy and J.C., whom he'd hardly had a chance to meet, he couldn't deny that he was enjoying himself. But soon it would be over. Sports reporters were tallying up the medals. America had done quite well, and the Aussies had done spectacularly well, especially in swimming events, in anticipation of announcing which nation had won the games. 3 more days and they'd run the marathon, traditionally the last Olympic event, followed soon thereafter by the closing ceremonies and the dousing of the flame. Already the runners were walking and or driving along the course to learn the hills and turns. They didn't want to get lost, though that would hardly be possible, as the route would be lined with screaming fans every step of the way. And they were working out, running in the training practice area of the Olympic Village, not so much so as to tire themselves out, but just enough to keep their muscles and lungs ready for the murderous exertion of this longest of foot races. Chavez considered himself to be in shape, but he'd never run a 20-plus-mile course. Soldiers had to know how to run, but not that far, and running that distance on paved roads had to be pure murder on the feet and ankles, despite the cushioned soles of modern running shoes. Yeah, those bastards had to be in real shape, Ding thought, lying down in his bed. From the opening day ceremonies, when the Olympic flame had been lit, through today, the games had been wonderfully managed and run, as if the entire national soul and strength of Australia had been devoted to one task, as America had once decided to go to the moon. Everything was superbly organized, and that was further proof that his presence here was a total waste of time. Security hadn't had even a hint of a problem. The Aussie cops were friendly, competent, and numerous, and the Australian SAS backing them up were nearly as good as his own troopers, well-supported and advised by the global security people who'd gotten them the same tactical radios that Rainbow used. That company looked like a good vendor to use, and he thought he might recommend that John talk to them along those lines. It never hurt to have an outside opinion. About the only bad news was the weather, which had been sultry hot for the entire Olympiad. That had kept the medics busy at their heat-stroke kiosks. Nobody had died yet, but about 100 people had been hospitalized, and 30 times that many treated and released by the firemen paramedics and Australian Army medical orderlies. That didn't count the people who just sat down on the curb and tried to cool off without getting any proper medical assistance. He didn't mind the heat all that much. Chavez had never been afraid of sweat. But he also paced himself, and, like everyone else in the Olympic Stadium, was grateful for that fogging system. The TV guys had even done a story about it, which was good news for the American company that had designed and installed it. They were even talking about a version for golf courses in Texas and elsewhere, where it got about this hot. Traveling from 95 degrees to an apparent temperature of 80 or so was a pleasant sensation indeed, not unlike a shower. And the concourses were often crowded with people in the afternoons, escaping from the blazing sunshine. Chavez's last thought of the night was that he would not have minded having the sunblock concession. There were signs everywhere telling people to be mindful of the hole in the ozone layer, and he knew that sun-caused skin cancer wasn't a pleasant death. So Chavez and his men liberally slathered the stuff on every morning, just like everyone else. Well, a few more days and they'd go back to Britain, where their tans would be noted by the pasty pale Englishman, and the weather would be a good 20 degrees cooler on what the Brits called a hot day. Anything over 75 over there and people started dropping dead in the street, which made Ding wonder about the old song that claimed only mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the noonday sun. They must have been a lot tougher back then, Chavez thought, falling off to sleep. Popoff saddled Buttermilk at about 6 that evening. The sun wasn't setting yet, but that was less than an hour away, and his horse, having rested and eaten all day, was not the least bit averse to his attention. Besides, he'd given Buttermilk another apple, and the mare seemed to relish them as a man might enjoy his first glass of beer after a long working day. Jeremiah, Honeycutt's horse, was smaller than Buttermilk, but appeared more powerful. An odd-looking animal, his light gray coat was covered from hindquarters to neck with an almost perfectly square mat-like mark of deep charcoal, hence the name Blanket Appaloosa, the Russian imagined. Foster Honeycutt showed up, hoisting his large western-style saddle on his shoulder, and tossing it atop the blanket, then reaching under to cinch the straps in. His last act, Popoff saw, was to strap on his Colt pistol. Then he slid his left foot into the left side stirrup and climbed aboard. Jeremiah, the stallion, must have liked to be ridden. It was as though the animal transformed himself with this new weight on his back. The head came up proudly, and the ears swiveled around, waiting for the command of its rider. That was a clucking sound, and the stallion moved out into the corral alongside Popoff and Buttermilk. "He is a fine horse, Foster."
"Best I've ever had," the hunter agreed. "The Apps are great all-around critter. They come from the Nez Perce Indian tribe. The Nez Perce captured the original western horses. They were the ones who escaped from the Spanish conquistadors and bred out in the wild. Well, the Nez Perce learned how to breed them back to the Arabian roots of the Spanish breed and came out with these." Honeycutt reached down to pat his horse's neck with rough affection, which the animal seemed to like. "The Appaloosa's the best horse there is, if you ask me. Smart, steady, healthy breed, not dizzy like the Arabians are, and damned pretty, I think. They aren't the best at any one thing, but they're damned good in all things. Great all-around mount. Jeremiah here is a great hunting and tracking horse. We've spent a lot of time in the high country after elk. He even found my gold for me."
"Excuse me? Gold?"
Honeycutt laughed. "My spread up in Montana. It used to be part of a cattle ranch, but the mountains are too steep for the cows. Anyway, there's a stream coming down from the mountain. I was letting Jeremiah drink one afternoon, and I saw something shiny, okay?"
Honeycutt stretched.
"It was gold, a big hunk of gold and quartz. That's the best geological formation for gold, Dimitri. Anyway, I figure I got a fair-sized deposit on my land. How big? There's no telling. And it doesn't matter much anyway."
"Not matter?"
Popoff turned in the saddle to look at his companion. "Foster, for the last 10,000 years men have killed one another over gold."
"Not any more, Dimitri. That's going to end. Forever, probably."
"But how?
Why?" Popoff demanded.
"Don't you know about the project?"
"A little, but not enough to understand what you just said."
"What the hell?" the hunter thought.
"Dimitri, human life on the planet is going to come to a screeching halt, boy,"
But...
They didn't tell you?
No, Foster, not that part.
Can you tell me?
What the hell, Honeycutt thought again. The Olympics were almost over. Why not? This Rusky understood about nature, knew about riding, and he damn sure worked for John Breitling in a very sensitive capacity.
"It's called Shiva," he began, and went on for several minutes.
For Popoff it was a time to put his professional face back on. His emotions were neutralized while he listened. He even managed a smile which masked his inner horror.
"But how do you distribute it?"
"Well, you see, John has a company that also works for him. Global Security. The boss man's a guy named Henriksen."
"Ah, yes, I know him.
He was in your FBI."
"Oh?
I knew he was a cop, but not a Fed. Anyway, they got the consulting contract with the Aussies for the Olympics, and one of Bill's people will be spreading the Shiva. Something to do with the air-conditioning system at the stadium, they tell me. They're going to spread it on the last day, see, and the closing ceremonies. The next day, everyone flies home, and then, like, thousands of people all take the bug home with them."
"But what protects us?"
"You got a shot when you came here, right?"
"Yes, Kilgore said it was a booster for something."
"Oh, it was, Dmitri. It's a booster, all right. It's the vaccine that protects you against Shiva. I got it, too. That's the B vaccine, pal. There's another one, they tell me, the A vaccine. But that one's not the one you want to get," Honeycutt explained on.
"How do you know all this?" Popoff asked.
"Well, you see, in case people figure this out, I'm one of the guys who helped set up the perimeter security system here. So they told me why the project needs perimeter security. It's pretty serious shit, man. If anyone were to find out about what was done, hell, they might even nuke us, you know," Foster pointed out with a grin. "Not many people really understand about saving the planet. I mean, we do this now, or in about 20 years, hell, everything and everybody dies. Not just the people, the animals, too. We can't let that happen, can we?"
"I see your point. Yes, that does make sense," Dmitri Arkadyevich agreed, without choking on his words.
Honeycutt nodded with some satisfaction. "I figured you'd get it, man. So those terrorist things you got started, well, they were pretty important. Without getting everybody all hot and bothered about international terrorism, Bill Henriksen might not have got his people in place to do their little job. So," Honeycutt said as he fished a cigar out of his pocket, "thanks, Dmitri. You were really an important part for this year project."
"Thank you, Foster," Popoff responded.
"Is this possible?" he wondered.
"How certain are you that this will work?"
"It ought to work. I asked that question, too. They let me in on some of the planning, 'cause I'm a scientist. I was a pretty good geologist once, trust me. I know a lot of stuff. The disease is a real mother. The real key to that was the genetic engineering done on the original Ebola. Hell, you remember how scary that was a year and a half ago, right?"
Popoff nodded.
"Oh, yes, I was in Russia then, and it was very frightening indeed." Even more frightening had been the response of the American president, he reminded himself. "Well, they, the real project scientists, learned a lot from that. The key to this is the A vaccine. The original outbreak may kill a few million people, but that's mainly psychological. The vaccine that Horizon's going to market is a live virus vaccine, like the Sabin polio vaccine. But they've tuned it like, it doesn't stop Shiva, man, it spreads Shiva. Takes a month to 6 weeks for the symptoms to show. They proved that in the lab."
"How?"
"Well, Kirk was part of that. He kidnapped some folks off the street, and they tested the Shiva and the vaccines on them. Everything worked, even the first phase delivery system that's set up to use in Sydney.
It is a big thing to change the face of the world, Popoff thought aloud, looking north to where the interstate highway was.
Gotta be done, man. If we don't... Well, you can kiss all this goodbye, Dimitri. I can't let that happen.
It's a terrible thing to do. But I see the logic of your position. Breitling is a genius to see this, to find a way of solving the problem, and then to have the courage to act.
Popoff hoped his voice wasn't too patronizing. But this man Honeycutt was a technocrat, not one who understood people.
Yep, Honeycutt said around the cigar, as he lit it with a kitchen match.
He blew the match out, then held it until it was cold before letting it fall to the ground, lest it start a prairie fire.
Brilliant scientist, and he gets it, you know. Thank God he has the resources to make all this happen. Setting all this up must have cost near on to $1 billion. Hell, just this place, not counting the one in Brazil.
Brazil?
There's a smaller version of the complex down there, somewhere west of Manaus, I think. I never been there. The rainforest doesn't interest me that much. I'm an open country sort of guy, Honeycutt explained. Now the African veldt, the plains there, that's something else. Well, I guess I'll get to see it and hunt it.
Yes, I would like to see that, to see the wildlife, how it lives and thrives in the sun, Popoff agreed, coming to his own decision.
Yep, gonna get me a lion or two there with my H&H 375.
Honeycutt clucked and got Jeremiah to go faster, an easy canter that Popoff tried to duplicate. He'd done this pace before, but now he found that he had trouble synchronizing with Buttermilk's rather easy motions. He had to switch his mind back into his body to make that happen, but he managed it, catching up with the hunter.
So you will transform this country to the Old West, eh?
The interstate was about 2 miles off. The trucks were passing by swiftly, their trailers lit in amber lights. There would be intercity buses, too, similarly lit, he hoped.
That's one of the things we're going to do.
And you'll carry your pistol everywhere?
Revolver, Dimitri, Foster corrected. But yeah, I'll be like the guys I've read about, living out here in harmony with nature. Maybe find me a woman who thinks like I do. Maybe build me a nice cabin in the mountains, like Jeremiah Johnson did. But no Crow Indians to worry me there, he added with a chuckle.
Foster? He turned.
Yeah?
Your pistol, may I hold it? The Russian asked, praying for the correct response.
He got it.
Sure. He drew it and passed it across, muzzle up for safety. Popoff felt the weight and the balance.
Is it loaded?
Nothing much more useless than a handgun that ain't loaded. Hell, you want to shoot it? Just cock the hammer back and let go. But you want to make sure your horse is reined in tight, okay? Jeremiah here is used to the noise. That mare might not be.
I see.
Popoff took the reins in his left hand to keep Buttermilk in check. Next, he extended his right hand and cocked the hammer on the colt. Heard the distinctive triple click of this particular type of revolver, and took aim at a wooden surveyor's stake and pulled the trigger. It broke cleanly at about 5 pounds. Buttermilk jumped slightly with the noise, so close to her sensitive ears, but the horse didn't react all that badly. And the bullet, Popoff saw, grazed the 2-inch stake, 6 meters or so away. So, he still knew how to shoot.
"Nice, isn't it?" Honeycutt asked. "If you ask me, the single-action army's got the best balance of any handgun ever made."
"Yes," Popoff agreed. "It is very nice."
Then he turned. Foster Honeycutt was seated on his stallion, Jeremiah, not 3 meters away. That made it easy. The former KGB officer cocked the hammer again, turned and aimed right at the center of his chest, and pulled the trigger before the hunter could even be surprised by the action. His target's eyes widened, either from his unbelieving recognition of the impossible thing that was happening, or from the impact of the heavy bullet. But what it was didn't matter. The bullet went straight through his heart. The body of the hunter stayed erect in the saddle for a few seconds, the eyes still wide with shock. Then it fell lifelessly backward away from Popoff and onto the grassland. Dmitri dismounted and took the 3 steps to the body to make sure that Honeycutt was dead. Then he unsaddled Jeremiah, who took the death of his owner phlegmatically, and removed the bridle too, surprised that the animal didn't bite him for what he'd just done. But a horse wasn't a dog. With that done, he smacked the stallion heavily on the rump, and it trotted off for 50 meters or so, then stopped and started grazing. Popoff remounted Buttermilk and clucked her to a northerly direction. He looked back, saw the lit windows of the project building complex, and wondered if he or Honeycutt would be missed. Probably not, he judged, as the interstate highway grew closer. There was supposed to be that little village to the west, but he decided that his best chance was the bus stop hut, or perhaps thumbing a ride on a car or truck. What he'd do after that, he wasn't sure. But he knew he had to get the hell away from this place, just as fast and as far as he could manage. Popoff was not a man who believed in God. His education and his upbringing had not aimed him in that direction. And so for him, God was only the first part of God damned. But he'd learned something important today. He might never know if there was a God, but there were surely devils. And he had worked for them. And the horror of that was like nothing he'd ever known as a young colonel of the KGB.
Chapter 36. Flights of Necessity. The fear was as bad as the horror. Popoff had never experienced a really frightening time as a field intelligence officer. There had always been tension, especially at the beginning of his career. But he'd quickly grown confident in his field craft, and the skills had become for him a kind of security blanket, whose warm folds had always made his soul comfortable. But not today. Now he was in a foreign place. Not merely a foreign land, for he was a man of cities. In any such place, he knew how to disappear in minutes, to vanish so completely that scarcely any police force in the world could find him. But this wasn't a city. He dismounted Buttermilk 100 meters from the bus hut, and again he took the time to remove the saddle and bridle, because a saddled, riderless horse was sure to attract notice. But a horse merely walking about on its own probably would not. Not here, where many people kept such animals for their pleasure. Then it was just a matter of easing his way through the barbed wire fence and walking to the bus hut, which he found was empty. There was no schedule on the blank, white-painted walls. It was the simplest of structures, seemingly made of poured concrete, with a thick roof to stand up against the heavy winter snows, and perhaps survive the tornadoes that he'd heard about but never experienced. The bench was also made of concrete, and he sat on it briefly to work on making his shakes go away. He'd never felt like this in his life. The fear, if these people were willing to kill millions, billions of people, surely they would not hesitate as long as a blink to end his solitary life. He had to get away. 10 minutes after arriving at the hut, he checked his watch and wondered if there were any buses at this hour. If not, well, there were cars and trucks. And perhaps... He walked to the shoulder and held up his hand. Cars were passing by at over 130 kilometers per hour. Which left them little time to see him in the darkness, much less brake to stop. But after 15 minutes, a cream-colored Ford pickup truck eased over to the side of the road.
"Where you heading, buddy?" the driver asked. He looked to be a farmer, perhaps 60 years of age, his face and neck scored by lines from too many afternoon suns. "The airport in the next town, can you take me there?" Dmitri said, getting in. The driver wasn't wearing a seatbelt, which was probably against the law, but then so was cold-blooded murder, and for that reason alone he had to get the hell away from this place.
"Sure, I have to get off at that exit anyway. What's your name?"
"Joe. Joseph," Popoff said.
"Well, I'm Pete. You're not from around here, are you?"
"Not originally. England, actually," Dmitri went on, trying that accent on for size.
"Oh, yeah? What brings you here?"
"Business."
"What kind?" Pete asked.
"I am a consultant. Kind of a go-between."
"So how'd you get stuck out here, Joe?" the driver asked.
What was the matter with this man? Was he a police officer? He asked questions like someone from the Second Chief Directorate.
"My friend had a family emergency, and he had to drop me off there to wait for a bus."
"Oh." And that shut him up, Popoff saw, blessing his most recent lie. "You see, I just shot and killed someone who wanted to kill you and everyone you know." It was one of those times when the truth simply didn't work for him or for anyone else. His mind was going at a very rapid speed, faster by a considerable margin than this damned pickup truck, whose driver seemed unwilling to pedal much harder, every other vehicle on the road whizzing past. The farmer was an elderly man and evidently a patient one. Had Popoff been driving, he'd soon establish how fast this damned truck could go. But for all that, it was only 10 minutes to the green exit sign with the silhouette of an airplane tacked onto one side. He tried not to pound his fist on the armrest as the driver slowly took the exit, then a right turn to what looked like a small regional airport. In another minute, Pete took him to the U.S. Air Express door.
"Thank you, sir," Popoff said as he left. "Have a good trip, Joe," the driver said with a friendly Kansas smile.
Popoff walked rapidly into the diminutive terminal and then to the desk only 20 meters inside.
"I need to get to New York," Popoff told the clerk. "First class, if possible."
"Well, we have a flight leaving in 15 minutes for Kansas City, and from there you can connect to a U.S. Airways flight to LaGuardia, Mr.
Demetrius," Popoff replied, remembering the name on his single remaining credit card.
"Joseph Demetrius," he said, taking out his wallet and handing the card over. He had a passport in that name in a safe deposit box in New York, and the credit card was good, with a high limit and nothing charged on it in the past 3 months. The desk clerk probably thought he was working quickly, but Popoff also needed to visit a men's room and did his best not to show that urgent requirement. It was at that moment he realized he had a loaded revolver in the saddlebags he was carrying, and he had to get rid of that at once.
"Okay, Mr. Demetrius, here's your ticket for now. Gate 1. And here's the one for the Kansas City flight. It will be leaving from gate A-34, and it's a first-class aisle seat 2C. Any questions, sir?"
"No, no thank you." Popoff took the tickets and tucked them in his pocket. Then he looked for the entrance to the departure concourse and headed that way. Stopped by a waste bin and, after quickly looking around, very carefully took the monster handgun out of the bags, wiped it, and dumped it into the trash. He checked the terminal again. No, no one had noticed. He checked the saddlebags for anything else they might contain, but they were completely empty now. Satisfied, he headed through the security checkpoint, whose magnetometer, blessedly, didn't beep at his passage. Collecting the leather saddlebags off the conveyor system, he looked for and found a men's room, to which he headed directly, emerging in another minute, feeling far better. This regional airport, he saw, had but 2 gates, but it did have a bar, to which Popoff went next. He had $50 of cash in his wallet, and five of those paid for a double vodka, which he gulped down before taking the next 100 steps to the gate. Handing the ticket to the next clerk, he was directed out the door. The aircraft had propellers, and he hadn't traveled on one of those for years. But for this flight, he would have settled for rubber bands, and Popoff clambered aboard the Saab 340B short-haul airliner. 5 minutes later, the propellers started turning, and Popoff started to relax. 35 minutes to Kansas City, a 45-minute layover, and then off to New York on a 737, in first class, where the alcohol was free. Best of all, he sat alone on the left side of the aircraft, with nobody to engage him in conversation. Popoff needed to think, very carefully, and, though quickly, not too quickly. He closed his eyes as the aircraft started its takeoff roll, the noise of the engines blotting out all extraneous noise. "Okay," he thought, "what have you learned, and what should you do with that knowledge?" Two simple questions, perhaps, but he had to organize the answer to the first before he knew how to answer the second. He almost started praying to a god in whose existence he did not believe. But instead he stared out the window at the mainly dark ground, while his mind turned away in a darkness of its own. Clark awoke with a start. It was 3 in the morning at Hereford, and he'd had a dream whose substance retreated away from his consciousness like a cloud of smoke, shapeless and impossible to grab. He knew it had been an unpleasant dream, and he could only estimate the degree of unpleasantness by the fact that it had awakened him, a rare occurrence even when on a dangerous field assignment. He realized that his hands were shaking, and he didn't know why. He dismissed it, rolled back over, and closed his eyes for more sleep. He had a budgeting meeting today, the bane of his existence as commander of Rainbow Group, playing goddamned accountant. Maybe that had been the substance of his dream, he thought with his head on the pillow. Trapped forever with accountants in discussions of where the money came from and how it would be spent. The landing at Kansas City was a smooth one, and the Saab airliner pulled up to the terminal, where presently the propellers stopped. A ground crewman came up and attached a rope to the propeller tip to keep it from turning while the passengers debarked. Popoff checked his watch. They were a few minutes early as he walked out the door into the clean air, then into the terminal. There, 3 gates away from his flight at A-34, he checked to make sure it was the correct flight, he found a bar again. They even allowed smoking in here, which was unusual for an American airport, and he sniffed in the second-hand fumes, remembering the youth in which he'd smoked Trude cigarettes, and almost asked one of these Americans for a smoke. But he stopped short of it and merely drank his next double vodka in a corner booth, facing the wall, wanting no one to have a reason to remember him here. After 30 minutes, his flight was called. He left $10 on the table and walked off, carrying the empty saddlebags, then asked himself why he was bothering. But it would appear unusual for a person to board a flight carrying nothing, and so he retained them, and tucked them into the overhead bin. The best news of this flight was that 2D was not occupied, and he took that, facing the window to make it harder for the stewardess to see his face. Then the Boeing 737 backed away from the gate and took off into the darkness. Popoff declined the drink offered to him. He'd had enough for the moment, and though some alcohol helped him to organize his thoughts, too much of it muddled them. He had enough in his system to relax, and that was all he wanted. What exactly had he learned this day? How did it fit in with all the other things he'd learned at the building complex in western Kansas? The answer to the second question was easier than the first.
Whatever hard data he'd learned today contradicted nothing about the project's nature, location, or even its decor. It hadn't contradicted the magazines by his bedside, nor the videotapes next to the TV, nor the conversations he'd overheard in the corridors or in the building's cafeteria. Those maniacs were planning to end the world in the name of their pagan beliefs. But how the hell could he persuade anyone that this was so? And exactly what hard data did he have to give to someone else? And to which someone else? It had to be someone who would both believe him and be able to take action. But who? There was the additional problem that he'd murdered Foster Honeycutt. He'd had no choice in the matter. He'd had to get away from the project, and that had been his only chance to do so covertly. But now they could accuse him rightfully of murder, which meant that some police force might try to arrest him. And then how could he get the word out to stop those fucking druids from doing what they said they'd do? No policeman in the known world would believe his tale. It was far too grotesque to be absorbed by a normal mind. And surely those people in the project had a cover story or legend, which had been carefully constructed to shunt aside any sort of official inquiry. That was the most rudimentary security concern, and that Henriksen fellow would have worked on that himself. Carol Breitling stood in her office. She'd just printed up a letter to the chief of staff saying that she'd be taking a leave of absence to work on a special scientific project. She'd discussed this matter with Arnie Van Dam earlier in the day, and gotten no serious objection to her departure. She would not be missed, his body language had told her quite clearly. Well, she thought with a cold look at the computer screen, neither would he, when it came to that. Dr. Breitling tucked the letter in an envelope, sealed it, and left it on her assistant's desk for transfer into the White House proper the next day. She'd done her job for the project and for the planet, and it was now time for her to leave. It had been so long, so very long, since she'd felt John's arms around her. The divorce had been well publicized. It had had to be. She would never have gotten the White House job if she'd been married to one of the country's richest men. And so she'd forsworn him, and he'd publicly forsworn the movement, the beliefs they'd both held 10 years before when they'd formulated the idea for the project. But he'd never stopped believing, any more than she had. And so she'd gotten all the way inside the government, and gotten a security clearance that gave her access to literally everything, even operational intelligence, which she then forwarded to John when he needed it. Most especially, she'd gotten access to biological warfare information, so that they knew what USAM RID and others had done to protect America, and so knew how to engineer Shiva in such a way as to defeat any proposed vaccine except those which Horizon Corporation had formulated. But it had had its own price. John had been seen in public with all manner of young women, and had doubtless dallied with many of them, for he'd always been a passionate man. It was something they hadn't discussed before their public divorce, and for that reason it had come to her as an unpleasant surprise to see him at those occasional social functions they both had to attend, always with a pretty young thing on his arm. Always a different one, since he'd never formed a real relationship with anyone but her. Carol Breitling told herself that this was good, since it meant that she was the only woman really a part of John's life, and thus those annoying young women were merely a way for him to dissipate his male hormones. But it hadn't been easy to see, and harder still to think about, alone in her home, with only Jigs for company, and often as not weeping in her loneliness. But set against that small personal consideration was the project. The White House job had merely fortified her beliefs. She'd seen it all here, Carol Breitling reminded herself,
from the specifications for new nuclear weapons to bio-war reports. The Iranian attempt at a national plague, which had predated her government job, had both frightened and encouraged her. Frightened because it had been a real threat to the country, and one that could have begun a massive effort to counter a future attack. Encouraged because she'd learned in short order that a really effective defense was difficult at best, because vaccines had to be tailored for specific bugs. And when one got down to it, the Iranian plague had merely heightened the public's appreciation of the threat, and that would make distribution of the A vaccine the easier to sell to the public, and to the government bureaucrats here and around the world who would leap at the offered cure. She would even return to her OEOB office at the proper time to urge approval for this essential public health measure, and on this issue she would be trusted. Dr. Carol Breitling walked out of her office, turned left down the wide corridor, then left again, and down the steps to her parked car. 20 minutes later, she locked the car and walked up the steps of her apartment building, there to be greeted by the faithful Jiggs, who jumped into her arms and rubbed his furry head against her breast, as he always did. Her 10 years of misery were over, and though the sacrifice had been hard to endure, the reward for it would be a planet turning back to green, and a nature restored to her deserved glory. It was somehow good to be back in New York. Though he didn't dare to return to his apartment, this was at least a city, and here he could disappear as easily as a rat in a junkyard. He told the taxi driver to take him to Essex House, an upscale hotel on Central Park South, and there he checked in under the name of Joseph Demetrius. Agreeably, there was a mini-bar in his room, and he mixed a drink with 2 miniatures of an American brand of vodka, whose inferior taste he was too anxious to be concerned about. Then, having come to his decision, he called the airline to confirm flight information, checked his watch, then called the front desk and instructed the clerk there to give him a wake-up call at the hellish hour of 3:30 a.m. The Russian collapsed into the bed without undressing. He'd have to do some quick shopping in the morning, and also visit his bank to pull his Demetrius passport out of the safe deposit box. Then he'd get $500 out of an ATM cash machine, courtesy of his Demetrius MasterCard, and he'd be safe. Well, if not truly safe, then safer than he was now. Enough to be somewhat confident in himself and his future, such as it was, if the project could be stopped. And if not, he told himself, behind closed and somewhat drunken eyes, then at least he'd know what to avoid in order to keep himself alive. Probably. Clark awoke at his accustomed hour. J.C. was sleeping better now after 2 weeks of life, and this morning he'd at least synchronized himself with the master of the house, John found, as he emerged from his morning shave to hear his grandson's first wake-up chirps in the bedroom where he and Patsy were currently quartered. Sandy was awakened by the sounds, though she'd managed to ignore the alarm on John's side of the bed, her maternal or grandmaternal instincts obviously having their own selective power. Clark headed down to the kitchen to flip on the coffee machine, then opened the front door to collect his morning copies of The Times, The Daily Telegraph, and The Manchester Guardian for his morning news brief. One thing about Brit papers, he'd learned, the quality of the writing was better than in most American newspapers, and the articles were rather more concise. The little guy was growing, John told himself when Patsy came into the kitchen with J.C. affixed to her left breast, and Sandy in tow behind. But his daughter wasn't drinking coffee, evidently fearful that the caffeine might find its way into her breast milk. Instead, she drank milk herself, while Sandy got breakfast going. John Connor Chavez was fully engaged with his breakfast, and in 10 minutes his grandfather was similarly engaged with his own. The radio now on a BBC channel to catch the morning news to supplement the print in front of him. Both modalities confirmed that the world was essentially at peace. The lead story was the Olympic Games, which Ding had reported on every night for them. The morning for him, all those time zones away. The reports usually ending with the phone held to JC's little face, so that his proud father might hear the mewings he occasionally made, though rarely on cue. By 6:30, John was dressed and heading out the door. And this morning, unlike a few others, he drove to the athletic field for his morning exercises. The men of Team 1 were there, their numbers still short because of the losses at the hospital shootout, but proud and tough as ever. Sergeant First Class Fred Franklin led the team this morning, and Clark followed his instructions, not as ably as the younger men, but trying still to keep up, and so earn their respect, if also a few disparaging looks at the old fart who thought he was something else. The also short-numbered Team 2 was at the other side of the field, led by Sergeant Major Eddie Price, John saw. Half an hour later, he showered again. Doing so twice in 90 minutes almost every day had often struck him as strange. But the wake-up shower was so firm a part of his life that he couldn't dispense with it. And after working up a sweat with the troops, he always needed another. After that, dressed in his boss's suit, he entered the headquarters building, checked the fax machine first, as always, and found a message from FBI headquarters that told him that nothing new had developed on the Seroff case. A second fax told him that a package would be couriered to him early that morning from Whitehall, without saying exactly what it was. Well, John thought, flipping on the office coffee drip machine, he'd find out in due course. Al Stanley came in just before 8, still showing the effects of his wounds, but bouncing back well for a man of his age. Bill Tawney was in just 2 minutes later, and the senior leadership of Rainbow was in place for another working day. The phone woke him up with a jolt. Popoff reached for it in the darkness, missed, then reached again.
"Yes?"
"It's 3:30, Mr. Demetrius," the operator said.
"Yes, thank you," Dmitri Arkadyevich replied, switching on the light and swiveling to get his feet on the carpeted floor.
The note next to his phone told him how to dial the number he wanted. 9-0-1-1-4-4. Alice Forgate came in a few minutes early. She put her purse in a desk drawer and sat down, and began reviewing her notes on the things that were supposed to happen today. Oh, she saw, a budget meeting. Mr. Clark would be in a foul mood until after lunch. Then her phone rang.
"I need to speak to Mr. John Clark," the voice said.
"May I tell him who's calling?"
"No," the voice said, "you may not."
That made the secretary blink with puzzlement. She almost said that she could hardly forward a call under such circumstances, but didn't. It was too early in the morning for unpleasantness. She placed the incoming call on hold and punched another button.
"A call for you on line 1, sir."
"Who is it?" Clark asked.
"He didn't say, sir."
"Okay," John grumbled.
He switched buttons and said,
"This is John Clark."
"Good morning, Mr. Clark,"
the anonymous voice said in greeting.
"Who is this?" John asked.
"We have a mutual acquaintance. His name is Sean Grady."
"Yes?"
Clark's hand tightened on the instrument, and he punched the record button for the attached taping system.
"You may know my name, therefore, as Yosef Andreyevich Serov. We should meet, Mr. Clark."
"Yes," John replied evenly. "I'd like that.
How do we do it?"
"Today, I think, in New York. Take the British Airways Concorde Flight 1 into JFK, and I will meet you at 11 in the morning at the entrance to the Central Park Zoo, the red brick building that looks like a castle. I shall be there at 11 o'clock exactly. Any questions?"
"I suppose not.
Okay, 11 a.m. in New York.
Thank you. Goodbye.
The line went dead, and Clark switched buttons again.